Welcome back to the Young China Watchers podcast. We're a global network of young professionals interested in China. My name is Joshua Cartwright. For this episode, we partnered with the Asia Global Institute at the University of Hong Kong, which focuses on presenting Asian perspectives on global issues. Alejandro Reyes is the Institute's Director of Knowledge Dissemination and host of the Asia Global podcast. Ahead of the 20th Party Congress in October, he discussed the challenges China is facing with Anne Listerid and Jason Lee. Anne is co-director of the Young China Watchers DC chapter and is an analyst at Strider Technologies. She specializes in China's macroeconomic conditions and government policies, as well as East Asia more broadly. Prior to joining Strider, Anne worked at Trivium China and the U.S.-China Economic and Security Review Commission. She is also a member of the Latinx China Network, or LACHINET. Jason is a DC-based research associate at the Stimson Center's East Asia program. His research focuses on U.S.-China relations, cross-strait relations, grand strategy in the Indo-Pacific, and China's approach to conflict issues in its periphery and the Middle East. He's also done work on the nexus of Chinese infrastructure development and Beijing's relations with developing countries. Prior to joining Stimson, Jason interned at the Center for Strategic and International Studies Freeman Chair in China Studies. In the excerpt you're about to hear, Al, Anne, and Jason discuss recent tensions over Taiwan, the state of China-Russia relations, and lessons from Ukraine.
So welcome, Anne and Jason. It's really wonderful to have you join us as our guests. We are approaching the important 20th National Congress of the Chinese Communist Party, which will open in Beijing on October 16. From the Congress will emerge a new leadership of the party, the Central Committee, the Political Bureau or Politburo, and the Politburo Standing Committee. The expectation is that incumbent Chinese leader Xi Jinping will receive a third term as General Secretary, or he might be named party chairman, a title not used since 1982. So this is really a good time to consider what is going on in China. Now, as it happens, there have been a number of developments that have put key issues in the China studies space, as it were, on the forefront, in the news. Especially issues that are, you know, these are issues that are central to the relationship between China and the US. Arguably, the most important bilateral relationship in our complex geopolitical world. So let's just dive right in. And Jason, let me ask you about Taiwan, because US President Joe Biden made comments repeating previous comments that he'd made. So these comments have become too frequent to be gaffes, where he's spoken of the responsibility the US has to come to Taiwan's defense. And he used this particular phrase, unprecedented attack from mainland China. He also intimated that while the US does not support independence for Taiwan, that was a matter for Taiwan to decide, which attracted a lot of attention. So we've had Nancy Pelosi's visit to Taiwan, which caused a lot of controversy and indeed caused an essential blockade of Taiwan through military exercises by Beijing for a few days, for over a week. And there has been a postponement of talks between the United States and China. Where are we now in this issue? And what do you make of Joe Biden's comments with 60 Minutes in that interview? Anne, let's start with you.
Sure. I will do my best, though I will admit Jason is a lot more knowledgeable on cross-strait relationships than I am. My impression, one element of this, I think, is very much we have leadership of two different countries talking about an issue that has this very charged international dimension, but also has a very charged domestic messaging dimension as well. And at least within the United States, I could see Biden and his team being very conscious of the fact that I think most average US citizens are unfamiliar with cross-strait relations and don't necessarily understand the context. I had friends that I went to graduate school with who focused on other regions of the world outside of the Asia Pacific, calling me up when Pelosi was going to Taiwan because they didn't understand what the issue was. So on one level, I could see Biden's message being very explicitly clear to a domestic audience that he wants his administration to be known for standing up in the face of authoritarian influence in democratic or democratic-ish smaller countries. And especially in the backdrop of Russia invading Ukraine, and enough of a similar parallel here, at least insofar that talking heads in the United States could pick up on it, wanting to explicitly draw those lines. Now, in terms of him stating the twist on the One China policy, as far as I can tell, and I defer to Jason on this, my understanding traditionally One China policy was that the U.S. acknowledges that there is one China and supports the peaceful resolution of disagreement on this issue of what the proper definition of one China is within the region, emphasis on supporting the peaceful resolution. The twist, as far as I can see, of what Biden's 60-minute statements is that's for the people of Taiwan to decide. I think it's something that in that more original statement was a bit broader to everyone in that whole region is going to decide it. But the other parameters of that peaceful resolution of this with the implicit, very implicit statement that the U.S. might intervene if there were, say, a military intervention, that I think a lot of those other dimensions have been made more explicit, but were implicit for a long time. The only new twist I see is the wording of the people of Taiwan to decide.
So Jason, were you surprised by what Biden said? What do you make of this development?
Well, what's the saying? Fool me once, blah, blah, blah. I think at this point, when we're talking about these Biden gaffes, there comes a point when we need to be taking him at his word. I think that within the international community and people in here in DC, there are a few times that we'll allow a slip up, and then it becomes very clear on what the president's thinking is on this. So I agree with you, Al, that we need to be thinking about this in terms or beyond the idea of these being gaffes. I think in many ways, this comes down to Biden's long policy within Congress, which is a place where a lot of this new pro-Taiwan sentiment is coming from at the moment. And it could be a sign of alignment between the legislative and the executive branch on this. I think one of the main issues with or questions about what's happening now with current U.S. policy on Taiwan is understanding the different messaging that is going out, particularly in how Beijing is seeing this. It's very clear how the Taiwanese themselves see this, as well as the U.S. public and the U.S. government as a whole. Strong emphasis on U.S.-Taiwan relations, people-to-people exchanges, continued support for Taiwan's defense, be it a commitment to defend or not. But the messaging, I think, that we probably hope to see become more clear is how exactly the State Department is addressing this compared to the White House and compared to Congress. Recently, the Senate Committee on Foreign Relations did its markup of the Taiwan Policy Act, which is significant piece of legislation addressing what the U.S. stance towards Taiwan is. And I think a lot of the concerns that some Taiwan watchers had about the original bill have been addressed in terms of the symbolism versus the substance of improving U.S.-Taiwan relations. So I think this is an evolving situation, but the Pelosi visit, I think, has really triggered a new public understanding of what U.S.-Taiwan relations are. And we saw that in addition with additional congressional visits and also state-level governments sending representatives to Taiwan. So it's I'll be looking forward to seeing how the White House and State Department and Congress kind of reconcile these issues moving forward.
Now, what about Beijing's reaction? There's much discussion about whether Beijing is on poised to intervene, take control of Taiwan, or whether it wants to take further action, whether it even has a timetable for reunification that it wants to impose, given historical dates, and we know some of those landmarks. Jason, what are your thoughts on the Chinese reaction and where you see things playing out in the run-up to the Congress and beyond?
I think on the run-up to the Party Congress, I think there's very little to expect in terms of new Chinese foreign policy. Xi Jinping himself has staked a lot of his own legitimacy and reputation less on economic growth and a lot more on China's position within the world. This comes down to his national rejuvenation, as well as his flagship BRI, and now in many ways, COVID policy, as well as the Taiwan issue and standing up to the US. So coming up onto October 16th, I think that there is very little to expect of dramatic changes in either Taiwan policy or general foreign policy broadly. And I would like to get your thoughts whether this would be the same for domestic politics, but I would presume so. So in terms of the long-term planning of the Taiwan question for Beijing, I think the response to Pelosi's visit is pretty indicative of Chinese thinking on this and the tactics that it's going to use in the future to push back against what it sees as U.S. encroachment or pro-independence movements in on the islands. We know that the original visit by Pelosi was postponed by several months, and I think that gave China a lot of time to prepare and calculate its response. Everything was ready to go as soon as Pelosi was in the air and then landed. The statements were very well timed out. But I think what that shows is that in the calculation, there were certain tactics that the Chinese decided not to use to push back against the visit. For example, they didn't overfly aircraft on the islands. The ship exercises were not as extensive as some might have predicted. So I think that it shows a lot in terms of Beijing's calculated approach to addressing the Taiwan issue. There are many people on the mainland looking at Taiwan, especially how the U.S. is addressing Taiwan. And I think even those people might not be able to give you a date, but they know exactly the red lines that would provoke them to take certain steps. So there are these milestones, as you mentioned, Al, 2027 for completing the modernization of the military. But then there's 2049 as well. So I think in the short term, very little is going to happen, obviously, before the Party Congress. In the medium term, I think that there's more ability to see what China is going to do, perhaps to push what peaceful unification would mean. In the long term, I think that's too difficult to predict. I'm not a betting man, but I wouldn't want to be betting on that issue at all.
If I might, before turning back to Anne, just follow up a little bit on the strategic side, because if you consider this whole idea of the strategy of denial, that I think has gone mainstream in the United States, that if it is indeed going to come to the aid of Taiwan, that it has to be prepared to do so. Do you see that as strategically a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy, as it were? In other words, if you build the arms, if you deliver the arms, if you deliver the military support, then you will get conflict.
Yeah, I think that's the key question, not only addressing the U.S.-China-Taiwan relationship, but also everything else happening in the Indo-Pacific when we're talking about increasing arms modernization across Japan, South Korea, and many other countries who are traditionally a lot more averse to such actions. So we're seeing a completely shifting region. But on the Taiwan issue, I think what's important is that the U.S. government has been relatively consistent in the emphasis of what defense of Taiwan means. And this is besides what is evolving with Biden and his statements. But since the Taiwan Relations Act was signed in 1979, the U.S. commitment has been to provide arms for Taiwan's defense. That's been unquestionable. And to have a policy live that long and be celebrated on the 30th anniversary was in 2019, to have it be so celebrated and so continually reinforced, particularly in the past couple of years, I think shows a lot of stability in the US approach. So a lot of the question comes to what is changing? And what is changing is that China is modernizing. It's putting Taiwan at the front of its great rejuvenation. And it's increasingly assertive, not only to Taiwan, but to the region. So I think that's something that we need to consider is who exactly is the making provocations and changing the status quo. And this, I think this gets to the question that we were addressing earlier about Biden's statement about allowing the Taiwanese people to decide on independence. I think I may disagree a little bit with Anne on, but only slightly in that a lot of the previous statements about and policies from Washington on this question of independence, the statements have always been taking a non-stance on independence. And I think inherent within that such a statement is the idea that who's going to choose to be independent? It's going to be the Taiwanese people. So I think that that's an important consideration also to consider.
Another big development has been the playing out of the China-Russia relationship. We've seen Russian President Vladimir Putin meeting with Xi Jinping on the sidelines of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, SCO, in Uzbekistan. And of course, that harkened back to their meeting on the eve of the Beijing Winter Olympics, where there was that statement about the no limits relationship. I'm wondering if you both could then reflect on, I mean, because this is not just a strategic relationship, it's an important economic relationship that certainly Russia has. How do you see this relationship as shaping up in terms of the, you know, what China is looking for? In terms of its relationship with Russia and how this might affect the China-US relationship?
Yes, that is an excellent question. The impression I've had is that Russia's invasion of Ukraine does not seem to have been expected by China's foreign policy elite, and definitely not by the commerce subsection of the foreign policy elite. I remember literally, I think it was less than 12 hours after the start of the invasion, Chinese regulators finally gave the rubber stamp to allow import of grain from Russia. And although it was a process that had begun long before the actual invasion started, since the announcement just happened to come out a few hours later, there was a lot of speculation made about it. My interpretation of that is, at least on that an economic development dimension of it, that this was very unexpected and not desired at all. Again, within that front, I think it doesn't serve China's economic goals to have such a heavily sanctioned trade partner right on their border. And, you know, even taking into account maybe more military or foreign policy diplomatic dimensions to it, it still doesn't serve China's interest to have an active war field very close to it with, again, its neighbor to the north. In terms of maybe the larger trade relationship between the two countries, it has felt for the last decade like a very unbalanced relationship. I think there's a little bit of a fantasy, or maybe at least an ideal, a hope for ideal among top-level leadership that there could be a friendship may be akin to how things were in the 50s, but the reality of it is it's a very imbalanced trade relationship. China has become a manufacturing powerhouse, and it has gone from beyond physical manufacturing into digital development and media development and a lot of highly valued production, physical and metaphysical, is happening in China right now. And the same is not said about Russia. Russia is highly dependent on being able to export energy At the same time, China is also investing a lot in alternatives to that form of energy. Now, until we really have a way to completely transition off of fossil fuels, including natural gas, completely, I think Russia will still have a great deal of economic sway. But that still tends to be a very one-sided relationship. China, in addition to putting all its putting a lot of energy into renewable energy creation and development, is highly energy dependent and has been hyper aware for decades that they are highly dependent on imports from other regions of the world. I think a big part of China's relationship with Venezuela is built on that. So in one sense, you could say that China views its relationship with Russia, again, on just that economic trade level, as a more powerful version of its relationship with Venezuela. And that is definitely not how Russia views its trade relationship with China. So right there off the bat, we have an imbalance. Throw into that sanctions, and that can get messy very quickly. China has, I think they've determined that they're going to continue to engage economically despite these sanctions. But I also get the sense that there's a lot of focus on what exactly, how exactly Western financial institutions react to that, at least insofar as trying to figure out, is this an additional source of international strain they're going to have to account into their own global trade relationships?
On a simpler level, do you think the sanctions that have been imposed by West and like-minded countries on Russia, particular exclusion, say, from the SWIFT banking messaging system, has that spooked Beijing in the sense that, well, I mean, they're already under sanctions in regard to the United States and European Union relating to human rights issues. But is that something that chastens them? And I also think about, when you think about supply of important commodities, action on Taiwan could also endanger their access to semiconductors, particularly the very high-end advanced semiconductors. Is Beijing deriving some lessons from what they're seeing playing out with Russia?
I think yes and no. My sense is that Xi Jinping cares a lot about the issue of Taiwan reunification on a personal level, but I also get the sense that he is very calculated in how to approach that. And my sense is that Putin was not quite as methodical in his approach towards Ukraine. I don't think that the reality of invasion were Xi Jinping to be thinking of an invasion, which is a big hypothetical. I don't think it would be with the same timeline as how Putin has been carrying out Ukraine. So I think that, for one, makes the two situations pretty different. For two, the nature of the sanctions between what has been enacted within Russia in the wake of Ukraine, essentially major state-owned enterprises or state-affiliated enterprises in particularly Russia's energy sector, but also individuals with a great deal of economic political influence, have essentially been cut off from use of the US dollar worldwide and any assets that they may have had outside of Russia. That is categorically different from the regulatory action the US government has taken against human rights abuses within China. The sanctions that have been leveled against China, human rights abuses against organizations like the Xinjiang Production and Construction Corps, those have been much more pointed and focused on specific organizations, or they have been focused on export restrictions, in which case the focus is on the physical things being shipped from one country to another, rather than cutting off that organization or individual's access to use the US dollar worldwide. It's the difference between bringing, a shotgun versus a grenade launcher. Like it's a very huge difference between the two. So I don't get the sense necessarily that this is a lesson learning situation so much as it is seeing the, I would argue, expected effect of seeing this level of sanctions applied to their neighbor. Now, end of the day, whether or not sanctions are effective, quote unquote, as far as Western institutions are concerned, depends on whether or not the receiving country changes their actions. And that has not happened. So Beijing might end up taking away from this that there could be, you know, economic trouble at home, but with the right, you know, combination of leadership or other factors, that it doesn't necessarily topple the regime. That could be the lesson that comes out of this. But again, that depends on how things play out 6 months, a year down the line.
Jason, you know, thoughts on this?
Yeah, I agree with a lot of what Anne said. I think what has been learned from the invasion of Ukraine by China is kind of many insights on the differences between Taiwan and Ukraine in those situations, I think. I think a lot has to be considered about, and the Chinese are probably looking at this, is what the relative size of the Russian economy to the world is in relation to the Chinese economy, what that means for how aggressive the West and other affiliated governments would be reacting to a potential Taiwan contingency, as well as it's kind of the strategic importance of, as you mentioned, Al, of Taiwan in the global supply chain of chips and everything. I think what this is might have taught Beijing, or what they might be taking away, is that in such a scenario, if China were to invade Taiwan today, I think it would be seen as premature in many ways within the Chinese strategic thinking, mostly in relation to the sanctions question, as well as on the question of decoupling and being able to maintain a strong economy if such sanctions were to be applied. In the Chinese optimal scenario, they would have already internationalized the renminbi, being able to avoid certain sanctions, been able to develop stronger relationships with other countries that are trying to get away from the US dollar. And they would have also had a stronger high level chip manufacturing themselves. So I think this shows in the Chinese mind what the cost of invading today would be, or in the short term, but also what they may be needing to be preparing for. And I think we've seen this in the past couple of months since the invasion, that the impetus to de-dollarize or to decouple, which we've been seeing since COVID, or since the trade war as well, might be even stronger for the Chinese for this exact reason of learning from the Ukraine example.
We hope you've enjoyed this excerpt of Al, Anne, and Jason's conversation. If you'd like to hear the rest of it, tune in to the Asia Global Podcast and follow the Asia Global Institute on Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, and YouTube. But before we go, there's one more clip that has special relevance to our audience.
Let's put China aside as a topic and let's talk a bit about what it means to be a young China watcher. I'm really intrigued. For the two of you, how did you guys get into the China game, as it were? And what drew you to study China? Anne?
I think the main thing that drew me to studying China, but when I was in high school, I loved studying world history and current events. And it struck me towards the end of high school that, at least now, I grew up in Philadelphia on the East Coast. At least on the East Coast, there was very little in our history classes that concerned anything involving Asia. Our world history class, I remember we did World War II, and it was Europe. Oh, by the way, Japan was there also. And it just left me with a lot of questions of, here's this huge part of the world that I just didn't know anything about. And so I started reading about Korean, Japanese, and Chinese history of my own, and I found it really interesting. And I just kept going at it. And I started in college by studying Japanese. And I, speaking of global financial crisis, I graduated before the job market had really recovered from the global financial crisis in the United States. So I took a job teaching English in China, and I loved the experience. I loved the people I met, and it just kept me in it, kept me coming back, and here I am now.
And you, Jason?
Yeah, I fell in love in high school as well, similar to Anne, of just the history aspect of it, but also what it means for present day policy. But on top of that, I think my father was born in Taiwan, and I think throughout our family history, there's always been that interesting question of what cross-strait relations is. And I think it's very fitting nowadays that cross-strait relations, or at least the U.S., China, Taiwan triangle is front and center. And it's something that I think I'm constantly interested in, because growing up, there was always these questions that me as a 10-year-old didn't understand of why is Taiwan different than China? And what does that mean for me being born in the US and having that background? And my dad always said, growing up, we always called ourselves Chinese Americans. And that was very interesting to me to unpack kind of the ideas of identity within Taiwan, what it means to be a Huaren, a person of Chinese ethnicity, rather than tied to a country. I think that all shapes into what we're seeing in the mainland's foreign policy today. So I think that's really launched me into wanting to join the think tank circuit here in DC and unpack these issues kind of at the intersection of both government, but also academia, and to experience what addressing U.S. policy towards the region is, and trying to inform it as best I can.
Thank you to Al and the Asia Global Podcast for hosting this conversation, and thank you for listening. If you'd like to learn more about Young China Watchers, go to youngchinawatchers.com to find out about upcoming events, read interviews with China experts, or replay one of our webinars. My name is Joshua Cartwright. Music in this episode is by Blue Dot Sessions.